It's fun to be inquisitive. Be nosy. Stick to your passion. Find out more for yourself. Quest is fun. Join me, Tristan Pang, on a journey of inspiration. Welcome to Youth Voices.
Hello everyone, welcome to my show. This is your host Tristan Pang on Planet FM 104.6. Youth Voice. Great to have your company here today. So recently I found a book called Mathematics for Non-Mathematicians by Maurice Klein. It has a great and very accessible introduction to math in it, so here is an excerpt from one of the chapters on the history of math. Aside possibly from astronomy, mathematics is the oldest and most continuously pursued branch of human thought. Moreover, unlike science, philosophy and social thought, very little of the mathematics that has ever been created has been discarded. Mathematics is also a cumulative development. That is, newer creations are built logically upon older ones, so that one must usually understand older results to master newer ones. These facts recommend that we go back to the very origins of mathematics. As we examine the earlier civilizations, one remarkable fact emerges immediately. Though there have been hundreds of civilizations, many with great art, literature, philosophy, religion, and social institutions, very few possessed any mathematics worth talking about. Most of these civilizations hardly gotten past the stage of being able to count to 5 or 10. In some of these early civilizations, a few steps in mathematics were taken. In prehistoric times, which means roughly before 4000 BC, several civilizations at least learned to think about numbers as abstract concepts. That is, they recognized that 3 sheep and 3 arrows have something in common, a quantity called 3, which can be thought about independently of any physical objects. Each of us, in his own schooling, goes through the same process of divorcing numbers from physical objects. The appreciation of numbers, as an abstract idea, is a great and perhaps the first step in founding of mathematics. Another step was the introduction of arithmetic operations. It is quite an idea to add numbers representing 2 collections of objects in order to arrive at a total instead of counting the objects in the combined collections. Similar remarks apply to subtraction, multiplication, and division. The early methods of carrying out these operations were crude and complicated compared with ours, but the ideas and applications were there. Only a few ancient civilizations such as Egypt, Babylonia, India, and China possessed what may be called the rudimentary mathematics we have today. The history of mathematics, and indeed the history of Western civilization, begins with what occurred in the first 2 of these civilizations. The role of India will emerge later, whereas that of China may be ignored because it was not extensive and moreover had no influence on subsequent development of mathematics. Our knowledge of the Egyptian and Babylonian civilizations go back to about 4000 BC. The Egyptians occupied approximately the same region that now constitutes modern Egypt and had a continuous stable civilization from ancient times until about 300 BC. The term Babylonian includes a succession of civilizations which occupied the region of modern Iraq. Both of these people possessed whole numbers and fractions, a fair amount of arithmetic, some algebra, and a number of simple rules about finding the area and volumes of geometrical figures. These rules were but the incidental accumulations of experience, much as people learn through experiences what food to eat. Many of the rules were in fact incorrect, but good enough for the simple applications made then. For example, the Egyptian rule for finding the area of a circle amounts to using to 3.16 times the square of the radius. That is, the value of pi was 3.16 instead of the usual 3.14. This value, though not accurate, was even better than the several values the Babylonians used, which one of them being 3, the value found in the Bible. So what did these early civilizations do with their mathematics? If we may judge from problems found in ancient Egyptian papers and in the clay tablets of the Babylonians, both civilizations used arithmetic and algebra, largely in commerce and state administration, to calculate simple and compound interest on loans and mortgages, to appropriate profits of businesses to the owners, to buy and sell merchandise, to fix tapes, and to calculate how many bushels of grain would make a quantity of beer of a specific alcoholic content. Geometric rules were applied to calculate the areas of fields, the estimated yields of pieces of land, the volume of structures, and the quantity of bricks or stones needed to erect a temple or pyramid. We now listen to Marcus de Satory's TED Talk on symmetry. He's a mathematician at the University of Oxford and actually is a fellow of the same college I am in, New College.
On the 30th of May, 1832, a gunshot was heard ringing out across the 13th arrondissement in Paris. A peasant who was walking to market that morning ran towards where the gunshot had come from and found a young man writhing in agony on the floor, clearly shot by a dueling wound. The young man's name was Évariste Galois. He was a well-known revolutionary in Paris at the time. Galois was taken to the local hospital, where he died the next day in the arms of his brother. And the last words he said to his brother were, "Don't cry for me, Alfred. I need all the courage I can muster to die at the age of 20. Now, it wasn't in fact revolutionary politics for which Galois was famous. But a few years earlier, while still at school, he'd actually cracked one of the big mathematical problems at the time. And he wrote to the academicians in Paris trying to explain his theory. But the academicians couldn't understand anything that he wrote. This is how he wrote most of his mathematics. So the night before that duel, he realized that this possibly is his last chance to try and explain his great breakthrough. So he stayed up the whole night writing away, trying to explain his ideas. And as the dawn came up and he went to meet his destiny, he left this pile of papers on the table for the next generation. Maybe the fact that he stayed up all night doing mathematics was the fact that he was such a bad shot that morning and got killed. But contained inside those documents was a new language, a language to understand one of the most fundamental concepts of science, namely symmetry. Now, symmetry is almost nature's language. It helps us to understand so many different bits of the scientific world. For example, molecular structure, what crystals are possible, we can understand through the mathematics of symmetry. In microbiology, you really don't want to get a symmetrical object because they're generally rather nasty. The swine flu virus at the moment is a symmetrical object, and it uses the efficiency of symmetry to be able to propagate itself so well. But on a larger scale of biology, actually symmetry is very important because it actually communicates genetic information. I've taken two pictures here and I've made them artificially symmetrical. And if I ask you which of these you find more beautiful, you'll probably be drawn to the lower two. Because it's hard to make symmetry, and if you can make yourself symmetrical, you're sending out a sign that you've got good genes, you've got a good upbringing, and therefore you'll make a good mate. So symmetry is a language which can help to communicate genetic information. Symmetry can also help us to explain what's happening in the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, or what's not happening in the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, to be able to make predictions about the fundamental particles we might see there. It seems that they're all facets of some strange symmetrical shape in a higher dimensional space. And I think Galileo summed up very nicely the power of mathematics to understand the scientific world around us. He wrote, "The universe cannot be read until we have learned the language and become familiar with the characters in which it is written. It is written in mathematical language, and the letters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures, without which means it is humanly impossible to comprehend a single word." But it's not just scientists who are interested in symmetry. Artists, too, love to play around with symmetry. But they also have a slightly more ambiguous relationship with it. Here's Thomas Mann talking about symmetry in The Magic Mountain. He has a character describing the snowflake. And he says he shuddered at its perfect precision, found it deathly, the very marrow of death. But what artists like to do is to set up expectations of symmetry and then break them. And a beautiful example of this I found actually when I visited a colleague of mine in Japan, Professor Kurokawa, and he took me up to the temples in Nikko. And just after this photo was taken, we walked up the stairs, and the gateway you see behind has eight columns with beautiful symmetrical designs on. Seven of them are exactly the same, and the eighth one is turned upside down. And I said to Professor Kurokawa, "Wow, the architects must have been really kicking themselves and they realized that, you know, they made the mistake and put this one upside down." And he said, no, it was a very deliberate act. And he referred me to this lovely quote from the Japanese Essays in Idleness from the 14th century, in which the essayist wrote, "In everything, uniformity is undesirable. Leaving something incomplete makes it interesting and gives one the feeling that there is room for growth. Even when building the imperial palace, they always leave one place unfinished." But if I had to choose one building in the world to be cast out on a desert island to live the rest of my life, being an addict of symmetry, I would probably choose the Alhambra in Granada. This is a palace celebrating symmetry. Recently, I took my family. We do this rather kind of nerdy mathematical trips, which my family love. This is my son, Tom Air. You can see he's really enjoying our mathematical trip to the Alhambra. But I wanted to try and enrich him. I think one of the problems about school mathematics is it doesn't look at how mathematics is embedded in the world we live in. So I wanted to open up his eyes up to how much symmetry is running through the Alhambra. And you see it already. Immediately you go in, the reflective symmetry in the water. But it's on the walls where all the exciting things are happening. The Moorish artists were denied the possibility to draw things with souls, so they explored a more geometric art. And so what is symmetry? The Alhambra somehow asks all of these questions. What is symmetry? When are two of these walls, do they have the same symmetries? Can we say whether they discovered all of the symmetries in the Alhambra? And it was Galois who produced a language to be able to answer some of these questions. And for Galois, symmetry, unlike for Thomas Mann, which was something still and deathly, for Galois, symmetry was all about motion. What can you do to a symmetrical object? Move it in some way so it looks the same as before you moved it. I like to describe it as the magic trick moves. What can you do to something? You close your eyes, I do something, put it back down again, and it looks like it did before it started. So, for example, the walls in the Alhambra, I can take all of these tiles and fix them at the yellow place, rotate them by 90 degrees, put them all back down again, and they fit perfectly down there. And if you open your eyes again, you wouldn't know that they'd moved. But it's the motion that really characterizes the symmetry inside the Alhambra. But it's also about producing a language to describe this. And the power of mathematics is often to change one thing into another, to change geometry into language. So I'm going to take you through, perhaps push you a little bit mathematically, so brace yourselves, push you a little bit to understand how this language works, which enables us to capture what is symmetry. So let's take these two symmetrical objects here. Let's take the twisted six-pointed starfish. What can I do to this starfish which makes it look the same? Well, there, I rotated it by a sixth of a turn, and still it looks like it did before I started. I can rotate by a third of a turn, or a half a turn, and put it back down on its image, or two-thirds of a turn. And a fifth symmetry, I can rotate it by 5/6 of a turn. And those are things that I can do to the symmetrical object which make it look like it did before I started. Now, for Galois, there was actually a sixth symmetry. Can anybody think what else I could do to this which would leave it like it did before I started? I can't flip it because I put a little twist on it, haven't I? It's got no reflective symmetry. But what I could do is just leave it where it is, pick it up, and put it down again. And for Galois, this was like the zeroth symmetry. Actually, the invention of this number zero was a very modern concept, 7th century AD by the Indians. It seems mad to talk about nothing. And this is the same idea. This is a symmetrical, so everything has symmetry where you just leave it where it is. So this object has six symmetries. And what about the triangle? Well, I can rotate by a third of a turn clockwise, or a third of a turn anti-clockwise, but now this has some reflectional symmetry. I can reflect it in the line through X, or the line through Y, or the line through Z. Five symmetries, and then, of course, the zeroth symmetry, where I just pick it up and leave it where it is. So both of these objects have six symmetries. But let's go back to symmetries that I've got for these two objects. What Galois realized, it isn't just the individual symmetries, but how they interact with each other, which really characterizes the symmetry of an object. If I do one magic trick move followed by another, the combination is a third magic trick move. And here we see Galois starting to develop a language to see the substance of the things unseen, the sort of abstract idea of the symmetry underlying this physical object.
Ah, yes, isn't symmetry wonderful? So that's all we have time for today. If you have any feedback about the show, please email me at youthvoicesnz@gmail.com or visit my website, www.questisfun.org.nz/youthvoices. That's QUEST-IS-FUN.org.nz/youthvoices. So, see you next month. Bye.
Join me again for another exciting program next month on the first Wednesday at 2:10 p.m. or listen anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/youthvoices or listen to the archive on my website, www.planetaudio.org. request is fun.org.nz/youthvoices. Youth Voices.